The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to Let Us Reason, a Christian-Muslim dialogue with host Al Fadi. Let Us Reason is a unique show utilizing theology, apologetics, and evangelism to reach Muslims for Christ by comparing and contrasting Christian and Muslim doctrines. And now, your host, Al Fadi.
Welcome, everyone. This is Al Fadi, and with me here in studio is Dr. Jay Smith, and we are continuing with our discussions concerning the Sana'a palimpsest. And of course, we are using this fascinating book by Dr. Stephen Shoemaker, and the title of the book is Creating the Quran. That's why we call this series Creating the Quran. Dr. Jay, we talked a little bit about the Sana'a palimpsest, why it's called palimpsest, the fact that there is an upper layer and a lower layer, and the lower layer usually is washed off, and then the upper layer was written on it, and there are some discrepancies between the two. What else we would like to add now?
Well, what we're doing is we're now moving over to this book here, the Sana'a palimpsest, written by Asma Hilali. This is the first book really written on the subject. That's why it's so important. Therefore, I encourage you to buy it. Go and get it. You need to get it because she actually unpacks it. She has page by page by page of all of that's there. So you can see actually it's written there for those of you who read Arabic. She then unpacks it and shows the differences between the different layers, and she shows where the variants are in red. So she's very clear there are variants. She clearly writes that out, so you see that. But what's fascinating, she admits that the radiocarbon datings, and she looks at the radiocarbon datings, which for this manuscript date between 543 and 643, and the other one 433 to 599. That's on page 20 of her book. Now, what's fascinating is when you look at those dates, that we know that the bell curve, that means the one that's most high, the highest part of the curve that would be the actual date. That the median curve, which would be the bell curve, would come about 593 A.D., which would put it before even before the date that Muhammad started receiving his revelation. He didn't start receiving his revelation until 610. So a good 17 years earlier is the bell curve date for that. So that would be problematic in and of itself. Also, if you look at the second date, 433 to 599, this precedes not only the most of Muhammad's life, which was from 570 to 632, but precedes the beginning of the Quranic revelation again, which doesn't come till 610. So in that case, she is aware of that this is a real problem. But put that to one side, as we said in the earlier episodes, that is the problem with the carbon dating. Mm-hmm. She also admits that there are no similarities between the lower text and the Quranic variant available to us following the Sunni as well as the Shiite compilation. She said this on page 22. So what were then are her conclusions? Well, she comes up with her conclusions. And you notice that almost every one of these conclusions, and I'm just going to go through five of them that she comes up with. First of all, she says that there are deviations. That's the name that actually Elizabeth Quinn gives to them, or variants. That's the name that Sadeghi and Gudarsi gives to them. So she quotes both of them and says, there are these variants in the lower tier. She admits that, 70 of them, 70 variants in 63 verses, which are variant from the Hafs text that we're using today, the 1924. I have it right here, this text. This is the one that was then chosen by Muhammad al-Husayni al-Haddad in 1924 in Cairo, then was made the official text in 1985 by King Fahd there in Saudi Arabia. So there are 70 variants from that text. She also, number three, believes that the lower text was the product of a reading circle. This is what you note as these student texts, a student text, and you confronted that very quickly because we're going to see why as we get the conclusions from the other scholars. And then number four, She notes that the upper text of the palimpsest contains even variants as well from the cuffs text. So even the lower and the upper ones aren't exactly like the Quran we have today. Therefore, both the lower and the upper text were corrected significantly at some later stage, at some later point. So those are her conclusions. Now, notice she keeps within the standard Islamic narrative by doing that. She doesn't sway outside. Although a lot of Muslims have been attacking her because they're saying, if you're saying that there are corrections, are you saying that there's some error? And she says, yes, but these are students' errors. These aren't official texts. You can see she's putting herself into a corner here, and that's a difficulty that that fortunately we don't have to deal with because we don't have to maintain that narrative. Mm-hmm. Let's go and let's see what some of the first of all, do you want to come back to me on any of that before?
No, it sounds good, and I appreciate the fact that you have synthesized the problem and the issue in here, and also you summarized her views correctly because I've been through the book many times myself.
Okay, let's then go and see what some of the scholars say, because I want to see what the scholars who have read the book, who are also working on this manuscript, who have been working on it longer than she has, which is kind of ironic. The person who actually comes out with the book is not someone who is really the scholar for the book. But someone like Elizabeth Pwin should have really written the book because she has been involved with this manuscript along with her husband since the 1980s. When they first discovered it, or when they first went down to look at it and take pictures of it. But here's what's interesting. Both Gerard Pwin and Dr. Elizabeth Pwin, husband and wife, both have doctorates. Also, Sadeghi and Gudarzi are the two others who have looked a long time at this manuscript. They all say this, at least. This is where they all agree, along with Asma Hilali, that the palimpsest is part of a complete Quranic codex that is a vestige of a non-canonical reading.
Mm-hmm.
Immediately there, that's going to get hackles of anybody who is a Salafist or anybody who is a radical Muslim or Orthodox Muslim, because that does suggest that there is a problem with the standard Islamic narrative. That narrative suggests there was no difference, no word, not one letter. It has always been the same since the time of Muhammad. Eternally, since the time that these have existed on those eternal tablets. Nonetheless, they, as the scholars, they are coming. That's the first thing they say. Sadeghi and Gudarzi, along with Elizabeth Pwin, believe that the lower text constitutes in itself documentary evidence of a non-canonical Quran. Now, those three do that. Sadeghi and Gudarzi, however, believe that lower text is related to a codex from Ibn Mas'ud. Now, do you know who Ibn Mas'ud is?
Well, he's one of the scribes of Muhammad. His name is Abdullah Ibn Mas'ud. If you go on Google his name, let's say, a lot of issues will pop up right away. For instance, Muhammad claimed that Ibn Mas'ud is where you need to go and learn about the Quran. He had an argument, Ibn Mas'ud, with Uthman. He refused to turn in his codex to Uthman. If you get exposure to the codex of Ibn Mas'ud, it has variations than the current Qurans and the list.
Dr. Arthur Jeffrey has done a lot of it.
Exactly.
And what's fascinating, he only has 110 surahs in his Quran, his manuscript.
Right.
We don't have his manuscript.
411 sometimes, yeah.
That's just what we're told, because there is no manuscript from Ibn Mas'ud from the 7th century. It's just their traditions redacting it back on what they believe were in there. But certainly his became very popular in what is today Baghdad. Of course, he was living, if he was a companion of the Prophet, he would have been living in the mid-7th century. He, according to some traditions, he knew 70 surahs before Ubay ibn Ka'b, or Zayd ibn Thabit. Zayd ibn Thabit was still a little child, and yet Zayd ibn Thabit is the one that was chosen for this book, the Quran that we have today. So you can see, Sadeghi and Gudarzi are saying there are enough differences, possibly that this is this comes from Ibn Mas'ud's codex. That's what they're saying. How do we know? We don't have it. Therefore, in some ways, this is nothing more than a guess. Dr. Elizabeth Pwin disagrees with all of them, and that you can see why. She believes that this has nothing to do with
Mas'ud. You should give her credit, because her and her husband have been studying this for decades.
Yeah. And she says, this can't be Ibn Mas'ud. You don't even know what you're talking about, because there's nothing about Ibn Mas'ud to compare it with. So therefore, this is what she just suggests, and I'm just going to quote her. She said, the lower text was in the process of being corrected and made more precisely canonical. And this is in Asma Hilali quotes her in page 15. She goes on and says that she considers the two layers as stages in a process of canonization. In page 16, she comes up with this. And then explains that the various categories of corrections as attempts to standardize the lower text. So she is very clear that this is a standardization. Let me just finish with her because she is the one that I think that that I would go with just because she's been working on long. And she doesn't have an agenda here. She doesn't have to support the standard Islamic. She's not a Muslim herself. I feel sorry for those who really have to support that because they're fearful of what might happen to their career or what might happen to their salary. In this case, Elizabeth Quinton she doesn't have no axe to grind. She doesn't also have a position, a chair to protect or a institution to represent. She said the lower text is neither Uthmanic, she says, nor from Ibn Masud. I already said that. So she concludes that this is nothing more than a process of being corrected and made more precisely canonical. Mm-hmm. This is stages in a process of canonization. So she suggests that the corrections predate the upper text. Obviously, they would. There were so many of these incorrections, and both were canonical. There are so many that at some stage the corrector abandoned the correction and just simply wiped it all off, washed it all off, and then started writing over top. That's what we have here. To me, that makes sense. This is an example of an evolved text. This is an example of a frustrated scribe who is – there are so many different things coming in. Could be he's looking at different copies. Could be he's collating it. Could be he's been told by others, that's not the right way to say it. Here's a better way to say it. Could be he had grammatical incorrections. As we're seeing, a lot of these are grammatically incorrect. That's why he then said, well, I give up. Let me just wipe it off and let me write over top.
Thank you. And in next episode, I would like to comment a little bit more on this myself. But what are we talking about next time?
We're going to actually go and see how different the lower and the upper texts are. And you're going to see there are lots of differences.
Absolutely. Again, I hope everybody's enjoying this. Continue to make your comments. Continue to share your thoughts. Continue to email us anything you feel is of help to not only something like this, a topic like this, but anything related to the historical criticism that we've been venturing into concerning the origin of Islam, or in this case, textual criticism of the Quran itself. Thank you, Dr. J. Thank you, everyone. This is Al-Fadi. God bless. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back after this message.
You're listening to Let Us Reason with Al-Fadi. We depend on the generous gifts of our supporters to produce this program. To join us in this work, go to patreon.com and search for CIRA International. That's CIRA International. You can also donate through PayPal. Go to CIRAInternational.com to learn more. Your support will help us continue introducing Muslims to the gospel of Christ. Now, back to Let Us Reason.
And we've been talking for the last few episodes on something called the Sana Palimpsest. It's basically an early Quranic manuscript. In fact, it could be the earliest. And it's called palimpsest because it had a lower layer that at some point was washed off and another layer known as the upper layer was written on top of it. Today, we are going to make some comparisons between the lower layer and the upper layer in terms of the textual differences. With me here to do all of that is Dr. J. Smith. Dr. J?
Back again. And we're on the Sana manuscript. We're on the palimpsest. And this is the one that you have studied in depth. You're very well aware of it. Much of what I'm saying is old hat to you. But we want to thank Asma Hilali because of what she did in her book. This is the book that she wrote that actually exposes for the rest of us who are lay, the people that will not never have access to the manuscript. She has given us every page. And she has shown us where the variants are. So how substantial are those variants, and what do they do to the script? Because I'm getting a lot of Muslims who are coming back on me saying, Jay, don't worry about it. It doesn't change the meaning. It doesn't change the doctrine. It doesn't change the practice. This is nothing more than school text. They had to correct it because the students didn't know what they were writing, and they had to just simply correct it to bring it back to the standard text.
Didn't we use the same argument concerning the New Testament manuscripts, and we said the exact same thing?
They're mimicking us. They're just taking what – and that is true because when you do look at the – and we're very well aware that these are written by men. We don't have this need – to prove its efficacy eternally, because we don't make that claim.
Exactly.
We don't make a claim of eternality. Therefore, we know it's written by men. Men are open to scribal errors. Men are open to even changing words depending on the exigency, adding a word here to make it more clear later on, or even scribes adding words. You know, if it's just the 12 men going with Christ, or did they go to the upper room, adding the upper room, the 12 who went, yep. Writing the word disciple after that, that changes the script, but it doesn't change the meaning whatsoever.
And I want to just clarify what Dr. Jay is talking about. The Islamic claim is that this Quran somehow is written on a preserved tablet in heaven, and that's where everything comes from. We don't make claims like this. We know the word of God is forever, is preserved in the heavens, but we do not make claims as our Muslim friends make, because they have pushed themselves in a corner and now they're having to come out now and try to come up with explanations for things, as we will show you.
It's even worse than that, because the Quran itself makes that claim in chapter 85, verse 21 and 22. The preserved tablets that you're talking about are in the Quran. It's internal the Quran.
Exactly.
It's also, the Quran itself makes that claim that it has never been changed in chapter 10, verse 15, mm-hmm. and chapter 18, verse 27. And why does it never been changed? Because Allah himself preserves it. Word for word, letter for
letter.
Chapter
15, verse 9.
That's chapter 15, verse 9. Right. So because the Quran makes that claim, Muslims have to make that claim. They're caught between a rock and a hard place, as we always say. So this is why this palimpsest is so damaging, because this shuts down and destroys that idea of preservation. It's obvious that the Quran was not preserved very well at the very beginning. Remember, we're talking about the earliest Quran in existence, the earliest palimpsest that we're going to get across. We're talking about the late 7th century to the early 8th century, late 7th century for the lower layer, early 8th century possibly for the lower layer, mid 8th century for the upper layer. So we're talking about, goodness sakes, we're talking about 70 to 80 to 100 years after Muhammad. You have two different layers with two different scripts. Shuts down chapter 10, verse 15, shuts down chapter 18, verse 27, shuts down chapter 15, verse 9, and especially eradicates chapter 85, verse 21 and 22. That's why this is so damaging. Mm-hmm. And that's why Muslims are they're suspicious. They are upset. They don't want the scholars to come to their conclusion. And so what they do, they say, Mr. Smith or Al-Fadi, this is not really substantial. This doesn't change a thing. We know that there's no doctrine change. There's no theology change. There's no practice. Let's see if that is the case. Let's just look at some examples. So let's go to the screen. Let's go to the screen and let's introduce it. So we have the lower and upper textual differences, comparing the Sana'a lower text with the 1924 Hafs text. So we're comparing the lower text, not the upper text now, the lower text, those 63 verses, with what we have in the Quran today. And let's just look at this graph here. Here you can see this is from Hilali's book. She looks and she shows on the left side the lower text there, chapter 2, verse 87 to verse 96, and also chapter 96, verse 105. Then you have chapter 8, verse 73 to chapter 9, verse 7, and also verse 16. And then so you can see all the way down, boom, 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 there are the 63 verses that are there on the lower text on the left and the lower text on the right. And then on the right side of each one is the upper text. So you can see the upper text is not complete as well.
Right.
At least complete with what the cuffs we have here. But that's, we're doing a comparison between these lower and upper texts. Now, what I want you to do, Al-Fadi, I'm going to go to the next slide. Look at the next slide here and look and see what we see. Here is chapter 2, verse 88. On the left side is the palimpsest, the lower script. And the translation in English is, "And they said, our hearts are wrapped. But in fact, Allah has cursed them for their injustice, so little is it they believe." And the bi-zulmihim, which is for their injustice, if you look at the Cairo text, the 1924 Hafs text, it's bi-kufrihim.
Right.
So go ahead and unpack and tell me what you see when you look at those two.
Well, when you look at both, I mean, the injustice or the word for dhulm, are we talking about judges who are not really implementing justice when they are coming up to verdict? Are they not using God's law, for instance, and that's why the word injustice is being used? Are they abusing the law and favoring a certain class over the other? Versus when you talk about for their unbelief or kufrihim, Here you're making a claim they're not believers at all. So who are we talking about? It makes a huge difference about the class of people you're addressing.
Absolutely.
And the action.
Okay, so that would be a doctrinal diff problem, and it'd also be a practice problem. So right there, you can see that is substantial. And that's just in chapter 2, verse 88, when you do a comparison.
Which considered, by the way, to be Medinan chapter, meaning like after Muhammad migrated to Medina.
It's a more recent one. Right. Here's another one of Medinan. This is chapter 8, verse 74. Now go ahead. I don't want to read the Arabic. If you can just read the Arabic on the upper left there, Jahadu, if you can read it out.
Oh, you mean the one way at the top?
At the top of the left,
yeah.
In brown.
So I'm going to try my best because this is basically transcribed or transliterated.
I should give it to you in the Arabic because you could just do it right off the top of your head.
جَاهَدُوا مَعَكَ فِي سَبِيلِ I think it's called فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ بِأَمْوَالِهِمْ وَأَنفُسِهِمْ. It's saying that a certain people have really strived with you. That's the word jahada here. How they strived or sacrificed with their givings, money, and also or wealth, and also their own lives.
Yeah. And there you can see it written right there. But those who have believed and immigrated and they did jihad, that's the struggle you're talking about, in the name of Allah, with their money and themselves and those who gave shelter and aided, it is they who are the believers. So we're looking at with the money and themselves. That is, because that is changed to jahadu fi sabili.
Fi sabilillah, yeah.
Now, that changed it to did struggle in the name of Allah. So where's this money in themselves?
Right. So now to use the 1924 version, there are so many forms you can strive in the name of Allah or for the cause of Allah. It's not just money and self. You can do other things to strive to please Allah. So it's a doctrinal issue again now.
And a practice
What can
issue.
You do to please Allah and claim that this is a jihad in the name of Allah?
Yeah. You can't use your money or yourself anymore.
Right.
This is just... In fact, they took them out of there and just strive in the name of Allah.
This is a general statement, technically speaking, versus a specific statement as in the Sana'a manuscript.
They took the specific out, okay? Can you see why this is damaging? I'm going to do one more before we move on, before we end off this. And this is on chapter 9, verse 2. Go ahead, if you can lead, because this is talking about Allah and his prophet. Or is it you take the name of the prophet out? So on the left side is the Sana'a column says, and here they have wa lamu anahum. I don't want to do it there because I'm desecrated, but that know that they and do not escape Allah and his prophet. So you've got the name of the Allah and his prophet, whereas in the Kyrene edition, which is the Hafs text, it just says, know you, not they, and cannot escape Allah. Yeah, so therefore, it's taken out the whole Jewish idea that his prophet is included in this.
I tell you what's so interesting about this particular thing. It's quite possible that you can argue, let's for the sake of argument, you know, that the one in the Sana'a column says was dealing with Muhammad as he existed. So there is a challenge now. You cannot really escape from challenging Allah and him. The 1924 probably recognized that, they relied on something, I should say, that says, well, Muhammad doesn't exist, Allah still exists, so now we'll make it just against Allah.
Yeah. Just one before and we're going to end with this one here because we have some more we want to go to in the next episode. But have you noticed that they call it the prophet and they don't use the word Muhammad here?
That is true also. I mean, there's so many things you can unpack here, obviously.
Muhammad's name is only found four times in the entire Quran. Right. This would have been a place they should have put it if they were going to standardize it. You can see they took not only the prophet out, they also took his name out.
Yeah, that's I hope people are seeing the damage that is being unpacked for them right now, especially our Muslim friends. I'm hoping that if you're watching this series, please, please, please look at it from just an academic standpoint, from the fact that we're revealing things to you. And we're saving you even the trouble of reading the book or the other books or the other sources, and we're unpacking it for you. For the purpose of you, go ahead and investigate it. I mean, we invite you to go and investigate our sources, investigate what we just shared with you, and decide for yourself. Does this tell you that a Quran that is in your hand is truly 100% perfectly preserved? That's the question. Dr. J, what's next?
We're going to now continue with this, and I want to start, I want to go on to, again, stay in chapter 9. I want to go to the chapter 9, verse 9, and then I want to get your take, because you've not seen it. This is the first time you're looking at them. I also want to look at verse 13 and verse 17 and verse 18 and verse 80.
You mean I haven't seen the slides? That's what you mean.
Yeah, the way I put it up here, I want you to see them, see like side by side. I want you to come up. Having not seen this before, I want you to just give me your reaction. That will be in the next episode.
Very good. Thank you so much, and thank you, everyone. Hopefully, you will join us back again next time. Until then, have a blessed day.
Star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.